Good morning. You are listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio with Celeste, and my name is Cecil. Today is Monday, April 18th, 2011, and we welcome you to our program this morning. This morning, we have an exciting program that I think many of our listeners should tune into and call and participate. Many of us have been impacted by the foreclosure crisis and many things that are happening. Many of us are in crisis, wondering what will happen to our homes, and we are living in fear. Many of our other citizens and residents are also in that state of uncertainty, but many people have decided, instead of waiting in fear, to take action. This morning, we will talk with Nancy Colbert, who is with the organization Good Grief America. She will share with us the work of that organization and how it may benefit all of us. Good morning, Nancy. How are you this morning?
I'm great. Good morning, Cecil.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And with apology to Charlie Brown, what is Good Grief America?
Well, that's an interesting question. We worked on the name for quite some time, and what we kept coming up with was Good Grief. You know, and this is an American issue that's actually spread throughout the world. So we deal heavily with our homeowners, and I'm one of them. All of our board and all of our staff and our volunteers are all people that are going through this. And what we find consistently with everyone going through it, it's almost like we're in a war zone, and there's a form of PTSD that we go through dealing with the issue. And so we find ourselves in this horrific grief cycle of denial and anger and bargaining and sadness and depression, and then finally acceptance, and then we can start proactively doing something about it. So, you know, besides the term good grief, you know, put that way, it's also, there's some good that comes after the grief. And once we can start getting a grip on this nightmare, we feel like it's a war zone that hits our home every day, and we want to know where Homeland Security is to protect us now.
Wow. So tell us about, you know, many of us are sitting literally in fear, as you suggested. Tell us about how your organization developed, when did it begin, and how did you begin to draw people together?
Well, personally, I've been in one aspect or another of the real estate industry for over 35 years. And the last decade, I owned a real estate office and was observing what was going on in the industry and was just horrified. I was probably the only one here in Southern Oregon that spoke out about the rapid escalation of prices, these horrific loans that were being offered to homeowners. I was told I had a bad attitude and I was going to ruin things for everyone if I didn't hush up. Mm-hmm. And I wished they had been right, and I wished I had been wrong. So, you know, when did I start? You know, we really started talking out about probably 7-8 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the last 2.5 years, I got so I couldn't even sell real estate. I couldn't list real estate. I realized the nightmare that was going on was far worse than even I had conceived. And we found ourselves in a situation where my husband and I are just up against, you know, retirement 2.5 years ago. And we realized we weren't going to retire. And we realized that the reserves we put away were not enough, and that the 45% equity in our home was rapidly dropping, and that we were in trouble. So we called our bank back in December of 08, which was Washington Mutual, later became Chase, and asked them for some help. We had watched that they had gotten bailouts and been promised, they promised the government that they were going to help homeowners with these massive bailouts they got.
Yes.
And the word we got was, we don't help people like you. And I said, well, who do you help? You know, we have a high credit score. We have a lot, you know, we have some equity. We have next to no debt, and we have some income, and we can work on building income back up again. And they said, you're not delinquent. you need to get 90 days behind. Mm. And that was contrary to everything I believed. And after 3 months of arguing with him, we finally quit making our house payment, our first and our second, so we could get some help. Mm. And instead of helping us, they threw us in foreclosure. And at that point, because I come from the industry, I looked at the paperwork we received, and most Americans, even realtors, don't understand the paperwork they receive. But I'd been around a long time, and I looked at that, and I pulled everything that was at the county, and I saw some very nefarious things going on. And that's where we seriously started pushing back. It was the summer of 09, and digging in, and some of the things I saw that I couldn't believe my eyes were this thing that later became known as robo-signing. Mm-hmm. I saw that on the paperwork at the county, all the assignments that were made from different entities to different entities to be able to create this foreclosure were all done by one human being, and her name was Barbara Hindeman. She was the vice president of MERS, making the first assignment, and then she was the vice president of Chase, receiving the assignment. And then from Chase, she sent it over to Bank of America. She was the vice president of both of those entities for those assignments. I saw her in about four or five different places on our paperwork, and I said, there is something wrong with this. And then we also noticed that Washington Mutual, which was becoming Chase, was our loan servicer, but Bank of America was the party foreclosing on us. And I thought, how could that be? So we dug into the SEC files, the EDGAR database online, and found some unbelievable things that were behind the curtain. And from that, we started pulling together other homeowners in our area and started talking, and then we started putting on workshops on what we had found. And we now have probably over 650 families that have been through our workshops here in the state of Oregon.
Tell us about the workshop that you have developed. What happens, and how long does the workshop last? What do people learn from that?
Well, it's about a 4.5-hour workshop, and we talk about the history of how we got into this mess. Then we talk about who's behind the curtain and how they're making money so that people can start to understand why they are not getting modifications, why they're not getting help, why they're going through this constant cycle of crisis, getting no help at all. When people start to understand what's behind the curtain, they can start regrouping and making a plan B, C, or D that they can win with. Going after a modification to get an actual mod has been pretty fruitless. Mm-hmm. Less than 1% of the people that have applied for the HAMP Act have actually gotten one.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk about the entities behind the curtain and how they profit. And when you understand that, you understand how to start dealing with them. And they do not come to the table in good faith. Then we lay out a buffet of options that people can pick off at the table. Now, here's some things we don't do. We don't do modifications. If people really want help with one and they want to go that route, we send them to a HUD counselor. Mm-hmm. We don't do refinances. We don't give legal advice. What we have developed is a network of attorneys throughout the state that are now educated on these matters we can refer them to. We don't have anything to sell. A lot of these workshops people go to, there's some big $4,000 package they're selling at the end of the day that is pretty much a scam. Or somebody promising to get them a loan modification for somewhere between $2,500 to $5,000. We don't do any of that. The good news is that the folks who've been through our workshops who decided to push back, as far as I know, the ones who seriously wanted to push back, and some of them had to hire an attorney to do so, they're all still in their homes now. And because of one of the rulings we got in the state, it was the McCoy ruling, and we worked on this one for 2 years doing the research and support on it, and it came down February 7th in Eugene. that actually stated that MERS was not a legitimate entity in the state of Oregon. And MERS is on 70 to 75% of our deeds that they're foreclosing on. And most of these foreclosures have been canceled and pulled from the dockets. Unfortunately, most homeowners don't know, and they're still sitting there in terror.
Yes. You are listening to KBOO-FM. This is More Talk Radio. I'm Cecil Prescott. We are speaking this morning with Nancy Colbert of Good Grief America. We invite you, our listeners, if you have some questions or concerns about the housing crisis and how you might stay in your home, give us a call and be a part of our conversation this morning. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. Nancy, how might people get in touch with Good Grief America?
Well, they can call us. We have a hotline for homeowners or interested people at 541-690-8334.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a website that's an online community people can join. It's free of charge to join. And it's like a Facebook, but it's a private community website. And it's at goodgriefamerica.org. O-R-G.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of videos, a lot of web links and information, educational information, plus groups they can join to go network with other people, whether or not they're in their region or they have the same loan servicer and they want to share ideas. It's a great site.
It's an excellent site. I recommend it. I also want to recommend what I think I heard you shared in part. Maybe you can make it more explicit, in that many times we sit alone in isolation and don't know what to do. And I think your organization also help us to connect with one another, find other people we can talk with.
Right. We have volunteers who we can get new people who call into our group on the phone, so they just have a place to share their story, get connected with other folks, and on the website. And probably one of the worst problems that this issue has created is the shame and isolation. And people just stay in their homes. They feel like it's my fault. The economy is collapsing, because that is the frame that was put out there by the media and by the Wall Street banks who actually created this. And in reality, it's not our fault. There were people who got loans they couldn't afford. Many of them didn't understand what they got. But nonetheless, these loans were pushed heavily on the American people and told them they should have them and that they were good. And now people are hiding in denial and fear. Many people will leave their homes at nighttime. They will just pack up the van and drive off in the night so nobody even knows.
Mm-hmm.
They're so ashamed. And unfortunately, that shame follows them, and their own emotional recovery and dignity doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And when people come to our workshops, even if they choose to not fight for their home, many of them leave the room with their dignity back and feeling good about who they are and less immobilized, so they can start putting together a plan to rebuild their lives.
We're speaking this morning with Nancy Colbert of Good Grief America. We're speaking about the foreclosure crisis, the housing crisis many of us find ourselves in, and how to push back. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. Give us a call if you have a question or comment, and we'll go to Jeremy. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. I just want to start. I'm going to ask a question sort of in a tenor of devil's advocacy.
Certainly.
But I do want to say that, you know, I think that Bush's Secretary of the Treasury and Obama's belong in jail. You know, all those people in Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and many banks. I used to play basketball with a guy who had a little mortgage bank, and he was laughing hysterically for years and years while he gave loans to people with massive fees. So I think these are the real criminals. However, what I hear a lot when I attempt to discuss that fact with people is hey, look, you know, one, something like 30% of people that are in default, they're in default on second homes. They were trying to get rich. They were using their houses like an ATM. And I certainly know plenty of people who did that. And the question is, should there be any negative consequence for that sort of, quote, irresponsible behavior? Yes, they were preyed upon. But, you know, for an upper middle class person who buys a second or a third house and then gets upside down on the mortgage, I think they should get hurt. Mm-hmm. And I actually would like you to speak more at greater length about your own experience, because you sound like an upper middle class person, and I have a feeling you were using your house like an ATM.
Okay, you know, that's a great comment. In fact, I was not. I own no second property.
I apologize.
I had 45% equity in my home when this crashed. I have none today. We had next to no debt. We were not over-leveraged for our income. We were working on being free and clear by paying off our home for retirement time. And I have to say that the majority of the homeowners that we serve are not from that market. We do see some of that. It's maybe 5% of our market.
I think nationally it's closer to 30, though.
It could be, but it's not the market we serve.
Uh-huh.
And we don't advertise or go looking for a market. We just serve the market that comes to us. 85% of our homeowners that we serve are small business owners whose businesses are taking a hit. Many of them have lost their businesses in this recession, and now they're losing their homes. And
I mean,
so,
weren't some of them greedily accepting ludicrous loans, you know, for 125% of value, paying hideous fees that they didn't have the business sense to make sense of so that they could expand their business or take vacations or, you know, I mean...
You know, I would say that there's some of that out there. The majority of them are not. We had a gal who called me the other day from somewhere on the East Coast, and most of our homeowners that we service are right here in Oregon. We do very little out of the state, but we do a little bit. She had 45 homes. I think she was doing that sort of thing. I told her we really, number one, don't have attorneys in her area to refer her to. We don't have the capacity to service her kind of needs. We've got very limited capacity. We don't get any government grants or anything. We have a lot of volunteers that keep our organization going. So we don't have capacity to serve that market. So I don't have a lot of commentary on specific statistics.
Okay. Anyway.
But
anyway. So I want to thank you. And I wasn't at all clear that you were that unpleasant example. But I was suspicious because I've certainly run into it. And it's about one out of three people I meet that are in trouble. I have massively less sympathy for than the two out of three who, you know, really, really got preyed upon. And I, you know, I don't want them to go to debtors' prisons. I want the people that lent them money and got rich off of it to be punished, you know, viciously for what they did. And as far as I can tell, that's never going to happen. And all we can do is protect poor people from further misery.
Right,
and I really want to thank you for what you're doing.
You bet, and thank you for asking. Those are good questions.
Okay, thanks.
We tend to not get into a moral issue one way or another because we don't have time to. And the minute, most of our people are just everyday Joes trying to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our people, because they're small business owners, can't even collect unemployment. They're pretty up against the wall with this. What we focus in on is the casino that Wall Street created.
Yes.
And regardless if it was an investment or the private home, every time one of these properties goes down in a foreclosure sale, all of the community suffers. So at this point, we're looking at alleviating as much suffrage as possible.
Thank you, Jeremy, for calling and sharing your questions and comments. Nancy, we're speaking this morning with Nancy Colbert of Good Grief America. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. If you have a question or comment about the housing crisis and foreclosure issues, give us a call and participate in our conversation. Nancy, as you continue to do your work and gather people together to strengthen them, to empower them to push back and fight back, I noticed that there are You're also working in the Oregon legislature, and I thought we might take some opportunity, some time to talk about some pressing bills that you are supporting there to help people.
Well, there's three bills going on right now in the legislature that, as the lobbyists call it, have legs. I think there were about 12 or 13 written. Mm-hmm. The ones that look like they're marching through, there's three main ones. There's one that's dealing with servicers, you know, the rules that they need to play by mm-hmm. in this state. I'm not sure that even if that one gets through, if it's going to make much difference, even though in theory it's a really good bill, and I think that it'll give grist to the mill for attorneys to go after them when they don't adhere to it. But the main one that we're supporting is one that just really tightens up. It's 484 that tightens up the our laws, talking about who can foreclose and what they need to produce to foreclose. One of the problems that is that we noticed early on, and because I come from a long history of real estate here, I know the real estate laws.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an attorney, so I don't give advice, but I have to know the laws for what I did as a career for years.
Yes.
And the laws clearly state we have two types of foreclosures. We have judicial and non-judicial. Judicial is where they go through a judicial process, has a judge look over to make sure to it that the party is who's foreclosing has legal authority to do so. Non-judicial is if someone's in default and no one disputes it, they just take the house. That is what we're seeing most of the time. And when, in fact, our laws have been grossly violated in Oregon, anything with MERS on it, which stands for Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems,
mm-hmm.
should not be in a non-judicial process. And that's something we've been fighting for. And to stop that process. And we've basically gotten that done. And we got that done without 484 passing. So if 484 doesn't pass, I think we've achieved our goal through the courts, but we're still moving to push it through to get these banks that they would have to show proof of what's called proof of standing. In other words, in my case, Bank of America's foreclosing.
Yes.
And we've done some in-depth research that most homeowners would never know how to do. That shows that Bank of America doesn't own our loan. And so we right now have a court case going in court, and we're suing them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't own our loan. They never owned our loan. Our deed and note never went to them. There, even a judicial process, I think, is dubious whether or not it could succeed. And all we have ever asked for is that the party of standing be willing to come forward and work with us on working out something on this loan. And they have refused, and most people can't figure out, why aren't they doing modifications? Why aren't they working with homeowners? The reason is, this was hard for me to get my head around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty hard to avoid now. The reason that nobody's coming forward to work with us is because nobody owns these loans.
Yes.
This is such a mess that Wall Street created to create the casino that they're spinning, that all they can do is foreclose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they foreclose and you don't object, then they cover up the mess they created.
Mm-hmm.
The Consumer Law Center in Washington, D.C., about 2.5 years ago, did a very in-depth report about the servicers. And I keep using this word servicer. Most people don't realize that the bank that they pay their money to doesn't own their loan and never did. They service it. Like, I thought Washington Mutual was my lender. They never were.
Hmm.
And the money came from a pool that sits over in the hands of Bank of America, but Bank of America doesn't own my loan either. And so what this report from the Consumer Law Center pointed out was that foreclosures are 46% more profitable than a performing loan. And what that means is that when these banks, these servicers, have the option of having a performing loan or a foreclosure, they make a cash cow on the foreclosures.
Mm.
and it has nothing to do with what they sell the property for. The math that goes on behind the scenes is unbelievable. And I think in an hour talk show, we really can't get into that in depth. That's why we have the workshops, is to try and teach people what's going on behind the curtain so they understand why they're not getting anywhere but foreclosure.
And if you are interested in attending one of these workshops, I recommend you give Good Grief America a call, 541-690-8334, or go to their website, goodgriefamerica.org. I noticed that you have some workshops scheduled for the end of April and through May, I saw on your website.
Right. We've got a Medford April 29th, a May 6th in Portland, and I think a May 10th over in Bend. We try and go out and do a little circuit every month and hit different parts of the state.
Excellent, excellent. A caller earlier mentioned that he was partly playing the devil advocate, but I think he raised some good issues in terms of how this crisis is played in the national, in the media generally, as well as how people feel about this crisis. Two things. One is that people, we all grew up with the American dream of owning our home. And that's something that for generations people have encouraged and we've worked for. At the same time, in recent years, as I think Jeremy suggested, many people were unable to finance their homes, unable to afford their homes, and were drawn into maybe something that they should not have even entered into. I suspect that certainly people who are in foreclosure feel shame and guilt and other things that you have mentioned. But as you suggested, I think there's a larger drama that's taken place beyond the homeowner who was sucked into taking a bad loan.
Well, if you think about, why would Wall Street bankers give bad loans? I mean, you know, when you start looking at that, it's because they were much more profitable than good loans. And it wasn't the upfront profit. It wasn't the fact that they had a higher interest rate. In the old days, when, you know, 35 years ago, if I had a client who was going to buy a home, we had three institutions in Medford we would go to, banks that I would shop the people around to, and they would pick a bank that they would get their loan from.
Mm-hmm.
And that loan, that money was loaned by that bank. They had what we called skin in the game. And they wanted that bank, that loan paid off, and they knew that if they made a bad loan, they were going to pay dearly, and that foreclosing on a property, they always lost money.
Mm-hmm.
So they were very cautious. They were conservative. They put pretty healthy loans in place for the most part, and sometimes people went belly up because of health reasons or, you know, all kinds of things would happen, but it was a small percentage. That's how banking was done, and banking was boring, and banking was pretty predictable. But what happened since 1999, when the Glass-Steagall Act was literally eliminated, there's a photo that we show in our workshops where a number of the legislators who got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act, which was the act put in place after the Depression so we would not have that kind of nightmare again. It showed them with a chainsaw cutting through the Glass-Steagall Act. They actually chainsawed it up. And they were quite proud that they got rid of this regulation, and that's when the casino started to spin. The money that was being loaned for these homes was not being loaned by banks. The banks involved were just intermediary middlemen who were making a large cutoff. And I'll give you an example. The McCoy ruling we got in February that has slowed the state down dramatically on foreclosures, he had a home in Central Point, $320,000 loan. As we dig into the in-depth into the SEC and Edgar database and we follow the trail of all the players who were involved in this loan, we found some interesting things that about it. The money came from a pool of money that investors. Mm. A lot of times they were our pension funds, they were insurance funds, there were all kinds of money that was invested in these pools, and then they pulled them out as loans. But they actually made bonds out of them. And so when the Wall Street bankers went to the pool to get the money, the $320,000 for Don McCoy's loan, they didn't pull $320,000 out to fund the loan. They pulled out close to $1 million.
Hmm.
And they put two-thirds of it in their pocket. And the reason they did it is because it was one of those designer loans that was an adjustable rate loan. And again, we can't go into the math on the air. But if they had gotten a fixed loan like I had on my house, they probably would have only pulled $380,000 out of the pool. But those adjust rate loans, those designer loans that they told people were good for them, that were smart ways to go, weren't smart for people. And a lot of homeowners didn't understand whether or not it was an investment or their primary loan. They really didn't understand. But what happened with that $680,000, and should that be legal?
Mm.
What happened was most of it went into parties' pockets on Wall Street, but a small amount went into buying something called credit default swaps. And what those were bets. And those were bets that Don McCoy would go belly up when that loan started to adjust.
Mm.
And according to their own formulas, they could have bought up to $9 million worth of bets. So here you got a $320,000 loan that they pull $1 million up front and up to $9 million if they can get Don into foreclosure.
Mm.
And you start to see this casino they're running. And who's on the hook for it? The investors are on the hook for it, the U.S. Treasury is on the hook for it, and our communities are crumbling because of it. So whether or not Don was foolish, Don was speculative, Don was conservative, doesn't matter to us. Every time a foreclosure goes down, we all take a hit, and
yes.
It's big.
Yes.
So our goal is to stop these things and bring Wall Street to the table, and we're actually making some serious traction on it.
Excellent. We're speaking this morning with Nancy Kober of Good Grief America, fighting back fighting Wall Street and helping to save our communities. Our number here, if you have a question or comment, is 503-231-8187. Nancy, you mentioned that we are beginning to fight back and make some real differences. What are the types of reforms that are being made today? What still needs to be done? And what resistance do you continue to face?
Well, you know, just this last week, all week long in the news, the OCC, the Federal Reserve, and the Office of the Thrift are pushing back on the Wall Street banks. And depends on what article you read and depends upon which entity, you'll see numbers anywhere from 10 to 17 banks that they're going after. Now, my read, just like the gentleman who called in before, is that probably none of those people are going to go to prison. If we go back to the savings and loan debacle back in the 80s and 90s that
mm-hmm.
went down, it was minuscule compared to the fraud that's going on here and the problems going on here. And thousands went to jail, and a fortune was fined out of these people. For some reason, they seem to be immune right now, and they know it. But what they will actually accomplish with this, they're looking at putting more teeth into these servicers, and I think that the servicers are going to be very, very adept at weaseling out of performing unless we hire an attorney. And that's one of the reasons we have built a network here in Oregon and a few outside the state of attorneys who actually understand these cases. And an attorney can be very expensive, especially if they don't understand the real issues. What we have found, though, is that if the attorneys understand the core issues and just litigate the real problems, it doesn't have to be that expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what our research does. What we do at Good Grief America, we do education, research, and support. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of our folks are hiring attorneys. It's not free, but for the most part, it's affordable. It's cheaper than moving.
Mm-hmm.
It's cheaper than paying rent. And a lot of us aren't trying to get out of paying for our homes. What we want is the party of standing to come forward and deal with us. Unfortunately, what we're finding consistently is they don't exist.
Which is so frustrating, and I think tells a lot about the crisis that we are in. It's as if it's all smoke and mirrors. There's, where is there? Who do we hold responsible? Becomes frustrating. What should people do? I know that, you know, you're not a lawyer or can give that type of advice, but I think your group offers assistance to people who find themselves beginning to sink. What should people do when they find themselves beginning to sink, besides, you know, refusing to open up the mail?
Well, the first thing is open your mail. Second thing is getting education. Education is key. I talk to people all the time. They go, well, I want to do the right thing. I owe them money,
mm-hmm.
and so I want to do the right thing. And I say, so what is the right thing anymore? When you start to understand what's really going on behind the curtain, the right thing becomes very convoluted. So they'll tell me, well, I'm going to do a deed in lieu and give my house back to the bank because I can't pay for it. And I go, well, that's an interesting concept. Make sure you get education on the cost of that to you and the ramifications. Here you are, quite often a small business owner, an unemployed person who has always worked and is having a hard time getting reemployed. I said, your income is down. What happens if they sell your house on the open market for $100,000 less than you owe? And they go, well, that's their problem. I go, no, it will become your problem because you will receive probably a 1099-C next year for the difference.
Mm.
If you're already in financial desperation and struggling, and next year you get a tax bill for taxes on an extra $100,000, will you be able to pay the taxes on that? And people just shudder. They go, well, how could they do that to me? I gave them the house back. And I go, they can do it easily, and they will. Same thing with a short sale. People don't realize that a short sale could leave them also in a position with a 1099-C coming for the difference. Mm. So they think that they're doing the right thing, the best thing, when in fact, in the back end, they pay dearly and don't even know what's hitting them. And then they find themselves so buried financially, they file for bankruptcy, and they realize they can't even bankrupt that tax bill.
Mm-hmm.
And it follows them for years and years and years. And so if you're not going to be able to work something out with the servicer and you're not going to fight for the house, many times, the foreclosure is an easier hit than the things that appear to be the best option. We don't tell people what to do. We tell people get educated. Go to your CPA and see an attorney. Spend a couple $100 and make sure you're making the right decision for you and your needs.
Excellent. We're speaking with Nancy Kober of Good Grief America. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. Give us a call if you have a question or comment about your home, what to do if you are in threat of foreclosure. Let me remind you that you are listening to your community radio station, KBOO-FM, and coming up this morning at 9 is the Omo Variety Hour, looking at Ayn Rand's philosophy of selfishness. And the Movie Mole's review, Atlas Struggle, a film based on her novel. Also, Bill Resnick talks with economist Marty Hart Landsberg about the importance of public institutions to economic development that makes lives better. At 10, Chris Andre host Air Cascadia. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein speak with Portland's Mayor Sam Adams and Michael Armstrong of the City Bureau of Planning and Sustainability about the Portland Climate Action Now campaign plans to help Portlanders reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. At 11 on Health Watch, the guest is biologist, author, and mother Sandra Steingraber, whose new book is Raising Elijah, which looked at how intimate world of parenting connects to the public world of policymaking. At 11:30 on Radio Zine, Elaine Jesmer, author of I'm Hot and I'm Bald, Chemotherapy for Winners, talk about how to handle the side effects of chemotherapy. And we want to thank all of you who are supporters of KBOO, and if you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the tip jar. But right now, we want you to give us a call here at 503-231-8187. We're speaking with Nancy Kober of Good Grief America, and let's go to Glenn. Good morning.
Good morning. So, yeah, I'm in this situation myself, deciding whether to do a foreclosure, a short sale, a deed in lieu, and thank goodness I'm in Oregon and I have a lot of protection with the title laws they have here. But that was a consideration for me in the I was going to do a short sale, and then I started doing some research and found out that I could possibly get that 1099 tax for whatever the difference was.
Yeah.
But then I started researching on that Obama bill that was passed, I think, 2 years ago, that was a tax credit for first-time homebuyers that also included a stipulation that I think it's until, until 2010, that people that did a short sale didn't have to pay the taxes on the difference, and then that was then extended by Congress until 2012. Is that correct or not?
You know, I can't say if that's correct because I hadn't studied, I hadn't heard about that. I know that the Bush put into effect something that was going to go through to 2012 that had to do with foreclosures, that you were protected. But I don't know about the Obama, and it seems like I would have heard about it. I can't say for sure.
Okay, well, I mean, I don't know. At this point, I don't think it makes that much of a difference for people, because if they're going with the big banks, I've noticed that a lot of them at this point for short sales and definitely for deed in lieu, they've put a lot of rules out there that you have to be current on your mortgage. And, I mean, everybody that has dealt with the banks at this point knows that's a big joke, because unless you start missing payments on your mortgage, they won't even return your calls.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's exactly what we dealt with.
Yeah, and then, well, I mean, in my situation, I think that the best thing for me to do is to foreclose, but I just wanted to put that out there for people who might not be that far underwater and, you know, might be fearing the tax bill to look into it a little bit more, because they might not have to pay it.
Well, they might and they might not, and that's why we won't give that advice. We say go to a CPA, go to a tax attorney, go get that. Our attorneys and CPAs are all telling us that the deed in lieus and the short sales are problematic unless you can prove you're insolvent, and being broke doesn't mean you're insolvent.
And I think that's also something that people should understand about Oregon, and I know that you won't give them this advice, but I could tell them, you know, go look, because I have nothing to lose. I used to be a real estate agent, and there are a lot of protections that you have when you foreclose on your house that you can lose if you try to do a deed in lieu or a short sale, so you need to look into it carefully.
Yeah, that we will say. And so foreclosure tends to be a better route. But most of our homeowners that aren't even going through foreclosure, they're just pushing back, and it's not that hard to push back. We've been 2.5 years without a payment, and we're not proud of that. That wasn't our plan. Our plan was to get some sort of a sustainable mod and just move on. But, you know, the lights are on and no one's home on the other side. And
so when they sent you the notice or put it on your door that there was going to be a sale, what did you do?
You know, it was really interesting. When we got that in, I think, July of 2009, I sent them a letter. I said, I smell a rat. And I sent them a letter and asked them 35 questions I wanted them to answer along with a list of documents. And the questions were very specific. I wanted them to show me, because Bank of America was foreclosing on us, and I'd never heard of them being associated with us at all. I wanted them to show me the true sales, the transfers of between me and the lender I started with every step of the way that went to B of A, and that's called the chain of title.
Did you have Countrywide at first?
No, I started with a broker, ended up with WaMu, which later went Chase as far as the servicing rights. But who knows? Initially I didn't know. Now I know exactly every player that was involved because we did the research. We pulled the whole chain, and I asked them to show me proof that those steps were ever done. And what they did was immediately, within a week of getting my request, they canceled my foreclosure and disappeared for over a year.
Oh, that's a good idea. I don't know that I want to stay where I'm at, but that might be an option for me if I decide that I want to.
That isn't necessarily working as well today. 2 years ago, they were running on that one. Then they started plowing over it, but now with the MERS issue, they're backing off quickly. So when people start to know whatever the issues are today that are scaring them, it's very easy to buy time with these entities. Some of our people just want to buy time. Maybe, you know, I've talked to families where maybe the wife's going through chemo, and they want 9 months. They want to buy 9 months to get mama well, and then they're going to move. Or maybe
the way I look at it is I put in a large down payment. I put in a lot of work into the property, and I didn't break the system, so I don't think that I should have to buy it.
Well, yeah, I agree, but if they foreclose, you will pay. Everybody in your community pays.
Mm-hmm. I realize that, but I will land on my feet.
We're into stopping foreclosures. We don't know the total outcome. What I do know is that the parties coming after us don't own these loans and don't have standing to do this.
I really don't see how they're going to be able to sell them either. And if this mortgage crisis is any indication of what will happen when commercial paper hits the fan, you know, we need to buckle up, because I know that still has not, that's coming down the road. It hasn't been resolved yet.
Yeah, the commercial paper is behind us, is ahead. I mean, it's behind this mess,
mm-hmm.
and it's coming still. Wall Street really doesn't care, because they've already left the country. They're siphoning this money out as fast as possible and investing in the Middle East, in India, in China. And they could care less if they leave our main streets collapsed. Our real mission isn't so much about foreclosures as it is about rebuilding Main Street. And what we know was they used these homes, whether or not they were the investments or primary residences, they used them as vehicles to siphon the life out of America, and that's why main streets are collapsing and we don't have jobs.
Well, you're absolutely right, and I'm really glad there are people out there like you fighting for this, and I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate your voice, and if you know anybody who does want to get some more education, we've got a workshop coming up in Portland. We asked for a $20 donation per household, but no one is turned away because of money. People are welcome. And, you know, get the word out. We appreciate it.
Okay, you have a good day.
Thank you, Glenn, for calling and sharing your story with us. If you have a concern, if you are in danger of losing your home or have a question, give us a call. We have a few more minutes. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. And have a conversation with our guest this morning, Nancy Kober of Good Grief America. Nancy, you mentioned in your conversation with Glenn rebuilding Main Street. How do we begin to rebuild Main Street?
Well, again, it comes back to education. If we don't understand how it collapsed,
mm-hmm.
there are a lot of ways we have yet to discover on how to rebuild it, but there's some basic ones when we understand the collapse. The collapse was that our money left our communities, and these loans were securitized in these pools, and the profits left our towns, they left our country. What we need to do is find ways to keep our money local, and one of the first things we ask our people to do is get their money out of the Wall Street banks and
yes.
put them into local credit unions and local banks. Secondarily, we have right now in Oregon a bill that has a very good chance of passing that we are supporting for a state bank.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a state bank, if you haven't done it already, probably worth having a whole hour conversation on, and there's some fabulous
people. We had a conversation a few months ago.
Okay.
But yes.
Mm-hmm. It's, if you look at the only state bank in the nation is in North Dakota, which is a very, very conservative state.
Yes.
And the state bank was started in 1918.
Mm-hmm.
And because of their state bank, their money doesn't leave their state and go to Wall Street to go into these casinos. Instead, it stays in their state and is recirculated. Their farmers have money for farming needs. Their small businesses have money, you know, to get home loans. They use their own money. All the municipalities, the tax dollars, these big dollars don't leave the state. They stay there. And the end result is that they have about a 4% unemployment. They don't have any of this foreclosure mess that the rest of the nation is seeing. They have a very stable economy. And so we are pushing to get a state bank, keep our money in the state, keep our money on Main Street in our local banks, and to encourage people to shop local. The big boxes have drained us.
Yes.
Shop local, buy local, recycle. I have people say, well, I have to go to Walmart because I have three kids. And I look at them and I go, well, if you're trying to save money, Goodwill is even cheaper.
Excellent. Excellent. I love that. We have a caller, Nancy. Bob is on the line. Good morning, Bob. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Yes.
Fortunately, I'm not in a foreclosure situation or anything like that. However, we refinanced our mortgage with Washington Mutual to get a lower rate, and the lower rate fixed 15 years. And when it flipped over to Chase, three times since Chase has gotten the loan, they've sent us things saying, you know, if you respond within the next 3 to 5 days, that you'll get a, we'll refinance your mortgage, you don't need an appraisal, you know, there's no fees, we just want to give you this at a lower rate. And that seems very unusual to me.
Well, I can only speculate why they're doing that, and we're hearing this.
Uh-huh.
I'm assuming, and I can't say for sure, they have a mess with all those loans they took over from Washington Mutual, a huge mess. And they didn't really buy the loans. They bought the servicing.
Uh-huh.
Those loans were in pools, and there's a convoluted, entangled mess, and if they can get you out of that, I think that they feel like they're going to have a better situation. It probably isn't for your benefit. I doubt very much if it's to help you whatsoever, and it may or may not. You can just be guaranteed any time those guys offer you something, they're making far more than you are on it. And I'm a businesswoman, so it's not like I'm down on capitalism. What they're doing is not capitalism. You can just almost be guaranteed it's something nefarious. And I would dig in deeply and check out what's the fine print on rolling of your loan.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, because it just struck me as odd that, you know, a bank would say we'd like to make less money on your loan.
Yes.
Yeah, well, they don't own the loan. So that's not the issue. And that's what people don't understand. What they do is they have the servicing rights, and they may have some mess in the servicing rights. Many of these loans also, in the huge bailouts, were paid off.
Uh-huh.
They were paid off by seven different sources.
Yes.
One of them, you know, is the big TARP. So those whole pools may be paid off. And if they can get you to create a new loan, there may be some additional incentive for them. Because if that loan's already paid off and they roll it, they don't even have to pay anything off. They just get a new loan and they've already been paid on the old one. And they're not about to tell you that.
Does that mean conceivably I'm paying on a mortgage that I wouldn't need to because it's been paid off by the bailout?
Conceivably, most of America is paying on a mortgage. There were some... what this bailout is costing, and the TARP money was just a fraction of it. People don't realize that these credit default swaps, most of them are going through AIG.
Uh-huh.
And many of our loans are not only paid off, but maybe paid off up to 30 times.
Wow.
This thing is a huge casino, and how do you know if yours is or isn't? Well, that's a real question of discovery. You almost have to take them to court to find out. In fact, you do have to take them to court to find out. And what they will do is throw you your loan before they'll ever let you into that discovery cage. And I'm not telling you to quit making your payment.
I didn't get that impression at all.
Hey, we're running close to the end of time, and want to
thank you very much, Bob. For your assistance.
Thank you. And Nancy, thank you for joining us this morning. Why don't you give the listeners information on how to contact Good Grief America and anything else in 45 seconds.
Give us a call at 541-690-8334. It is a voicemail, and one of our team, our volunteers, will call you back. Also, join us at www.goodgriefamerica.org. Or join us at one of our workshops coming up throughout the state in Medford on the 29th of April, May 6th in Portland, and May 10th in Bend. And I thank you, Cecil, for having me on the show.
Thank you, Nancy. And you have been listening to More Talk Radio. Stay tuned for more great programming. Up next is the OMO Variety Hour. Thank you.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this April 17th Monday. Joe Clement is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, we'll explore the importance of public institutions, the virtues of selfishness, and the new film Atlas Shrugged, and the economics of class warfare. We open today's show with Bill Resnick talking to Marty Hart Landsberg, professor of economics and director of the political economy program at Lewis and Clark College here in Portland, Oregon. They discuss the key role of healthy, decently paid, and moralized public institutions in the process of economic development. This a challenge to the conservative claim that expenditures for public goods are a drag on economic growth. Clayton Mortgage and Joe Clement discuss Russian-American writer Ayn Rand's objectivist philosophy, specifically her belief in the virtues of selfishness. And in the second half of our show, Joe Clement returns with movie mole Fran Michel to discuss and review the newly released film version of Ayn Rand's final novel, Atlas Shrugged, described by Rand as an exploration of, quote, the role of man's mind in existence. And Tom Becker will end today's show with a look at writer Mike Whitney's recent post on keepthemiddleclassalive.com, Class Warfare Scoreboard, Guess Who's Winning? This is Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and thanks for tuning in this morning. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm, Old Mole Variety Hour. And now we turn to Bill Resnick and Marty Hart Landsberg.
Thanks, Denise. Martin Hart Landsberg, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Martin Hart Landsberg teaches here in Portland at Lewis and Clark. He's written many books and articles, mostly on economic development, on Korea, China, Mexico, among many others. And for the last few years, developed a blog, Reports from the Economic Front, discussing in many, many short pieces, accessible and really interesting, economic issues facing this planet, and particularly the United States. Marty Hart Landsberg, over the last 30 years, conservatives and the rich have succeeded in convincing people that public programs, services, and the taxes required to support them, well, they're just drags on the economy. They reduce human well-being. And to build a big, good economy, conservatives argue, we must reduce taxes and reduce regulations and eliminate state interference on that to allow that great engine of prosperity and development, the private entrepreneurial apparatus, allow it to serve the public good. What's the real story on the relationships between the state and economic development?
Wow, that's an important starting point and a critical one. And I think that we really are in a period where working people are realizing the economy isn't working. And I think that they're not particularly taken with the notion that more free markets will really work, but I think that they're confused, and they're confused about alternatives. And therefore, I think they're very vulnerable to the kind of drumbeat of advocacy for more tax cuts, you know, the government is the problem, everything you said. And I guess it's worth sort of stepping back and first saying, you know, we often use the word neoliberalism or free markets, this idea that, you know, lower taxes, more freedom for corporations to move, less government regulation is really an answer. And I think that we have to understand that neoliberalism, this package of free market stuff, is really a number of different things. It's an ideology, which is what we're presented. It's going to give us individual freedom and opportunity. It's a political project by powerful corporate interests to make profits, and it's also a set of policies. And I think the political project dominates, that therefore, you know, when we had this enormous economic crisis, what happens? You know, the big banks and the auto companies and everybody says, please, government, you know, bail us out. You know, it's part of the political project. When we say, well, we want the free market, but we negotiate free trade agreements that extend, you know, patent rights and push more monopolies for pharmaceutical companies, you know, that's not a problem. So we really have to understand what's going on here, and that's a matter of really political power. Now, we've had a 20 or 30 year experiment with cutting taxes. I mean, beginning in the 1980s, with the Reagan administration, but supported by most big corporations and the media, the argument was if we cut taxes and free up businesses, sign free trade agreements, enhance corporate mobility, we're going to have this outpouring of investment and outpouring of growth. And what we really saw, and which includes destroying unions, that was an important part of the early start as well. All this sounds very familiar. The reality is we had very poor growth in the 1980s, mostly stagnation. We didn't do very well in the early 90s. And we had these sort of brief spurts of growth in the late 90s and through the 2000s, which were largely supported by these debt bubbles. And even when those were taking place, average incomes were falling. I mean, from 2001 to 2007, the average household income, the median income, actually declined. So what we have is really proof that, on the ground proof, that the theory aside, business did not take money, did not invest it in plant and equipment, investment fell, did not promote more jobs, job creation declined, did not increase standard of living, wages fell, and median income fell. But working people became deeper in debt with less health care and fewer public services. Now, when
and of course, lower wages.
Exactly.
Marty, let's backtrack, though, a little, just to talk about the role of the public and of the state, even in economic development, let's say in Europe or in Asia, and in the United States during 50 years ago. That is, during capitalist regimes, some of which are more humane than others. The state, though, for any kind of economic development, a honest and effective public services are absolutely fundamental in many ways. Why don't we just list the things that the public does? I think we have to get concrete about that.
Well, and you know, one sort of starting point here, we often celebrate countries like Korea or Taiwan as these, you know, models of economic development, or even, you know, China, you know, with all their failings in terms of labor rights, they're still held up by mainstream economists as economic successes. And I would say one of the starting points is every one of those countries had fully state-owned banking systems. Finance was directed not by markets, but by government planners who said, these are sectors we want to invest in, and that money is going to be invested in productive channels, and they set up policy loans, and they organized things. This wasn't market. This was planning.
Right. In Europe as well, although they weren't fully owned, but in fact the regulatory apparatus, let's say in Germany, used to be enormously effective and constrained banks a whole lot, forced money into actual real investment.
Yes. So, I mean, if you just realize there's a whole range of things that can happen, even in a capitalist economy, and that the more successful ones, in effect, have in fact relied on, you know, substantial state intervention to direct economic activity. But just going back to your question, I mean, if we think of some of the big growth centers in the United States, you know, the internet and software, it came from basically industrial policy done through the military. If you think of aerospace, one of our big exports, again, it came through industrial policy done through the military.
Biomedical research. I mean, the U.S., we don't really know of it, but in fact, the U.S. has this enormous concentration of research universities. That is through the, what was it called? The
DARPA?
The Land Act. Oh. No, the, you know, the, in any event, the University of Michigan and Wisconsin and all over this country, they received enormous amounts of money, actually, out of the federal government to create research universities.
Sure.
And they've been enormously important, not to mention the National Institute of Health.
Sure.
Enormously important.
Most of the pharmaceuticals, the research and development has been publicly financed. People often say if we don't give these companies lots of profits, there won't be any research.
No.
More than 65% of the research monies come from the public sector. Yeah. It's just that the private sector appropriates the product.
The drug companies spend far more on advertising than they do on research. In fact, they're getting out of research and giving it to the state.
I mean, we can't have an economy that functions well for people if we don't have good infrastructure, if we don't have good transportation, if we don't have good, you know, urban planning, if we don't have education, healthcare, and if we don't have government creating the frameworks for innovation and productive investment.
Yeah.
And what's happened is that the government has increasingly pulled back from that, and that's one of the reasons why what we've had is this enormous development of the financialization of the economy and an outright decline in economic job creation. So, I mean, and what we've got here is a very weak economy as far as the underpinnings necessary for sustainable and responsive growth, responsive meaning decent salaries. I mean, again, you know, we talk about technology. One of the ways in which you get technology is not only by investing, but by union laws, health and safety laws, controls on capital mobility that force companies to invest, to upgrade their equipment, to upgrade their productivity. And the more we back away from all those things, negotiate free trade agreements, weaken unions, the more we pursue and enable a low-wage economic strategy to take place, which again reinforces debt, reinforces all these economic weaknesses.
Yeah, not to mention the sort of Keynesian argument that this is in capitalism. It's constant crises, depressions, recessions. The only way out of them, because they will spiral down, is for an active public, an active government that in fact stimulates the economy.
Yep, and you can't do that without taxing. And you know what's really happened is we've had these steady declines in personal tax rates for the rich and for corporations, and of course, you know, war spending, which is not necessarily the most productive way to use government revenue, but we've essentially yielded any of the wealth that we're creating to go back. You know, we've yielded the power to bring it back into the commons and to use it to sustain a healthy economy. I think it's really important that we understand that we've been in an expansion since June of 2009. And, you know, economies, as you mentioned, Keynesianism, you know, we know that we have a business cycle. And what we're seeing here is an expansion from one of the worst, you know, collapses that we've had since the Great Depression, and we see how weak it is. And if we say, well, where is this recovery going to come from? You know, banks have over $1 trillion in reserves. Before the economic crisis in 2008, they had $20 billion. Now they have over $1 trillion. Companies are sitting on huge amount of cash. They're not interested in investing in any kind of productive activity. Financial profits as a share of total profits is back up almost to what it was before the crash in 2008. So we have an economy that has got the same structure it had before, with finance dominating, a lack of productive investment, profits are back up, but without this, without these bubbles, it's even weaker. And at some point, if the corporate interests succeed at getting us to cut more taxes, to squeeze state and local governments, to cut back unions, it's not going to be very long before we go back into another recession. And this is the good times. This is when, you know, under a healthy economy, you should be putting away money for roads and bridges. You should be dealing with health care. People should be earning good salaries. We're not doing that in the good times. So we're on a really significant downward trajectory here. And if we allow these understandings to dominate the public debate, you know, squeezing taxes, cutting government, breaking unions, the future is going to be very, very bad for the great majority of us.
But the rich will get famously rich, and the Midas, you can choke on it. Let's, in fact, talk about that. Marty, let me do a station ID, and then we'll get back a little more specifically about what the rich do with their money and power, and then get to the democratization of the state. This is KB Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Marty Hart Landsberg, who writes a great deal, find him on Google, and also does a wonderful blog, Reports from the Economic Front. Marty, we've been discussing the key role and great importance of state and public services and economic development. Later, near the end of the show, I think we have to save some time to talk about the dangers of a big state, actually, and how we democratize the state and democratize production. Right now, let's spend a few minutes, though, talking about what the rich do with their money. They're getting fabulously rich. They become more and more destructive. As they get more rich and more powerful, they become more destructive, and it seems they don't invest. In fact, what they do invest in is protecting themselves and somehow gaining more money. Let's talk about the very pernicious effect of enriching this top one half of 1%.
Before we do that, I want to just step back for 1 second, because there's an argument that's made that, you know, the rich are being sort of self-destructive. They're pursuing policies that are bound to cause more problems. And so shouldn't we have confidence that they're going to, you know, join us and see the error of their ways? And I think it's important to realize that when this big economic crisis hit in 2008, and they called for massive financial bailouts, which they received from the U.S. government, Treasury buying trillions of dollars of bad assets, money getting pumped in here and there that helped to restore the same structure and the same wealth, I think there was a period when people were really angry and really wanted change. And we were talking about, you know, the need for, you know, single-payer health care and take over the banks and all sorts of demands. And I think what the wealthy did, what the dominant corporations, the business roundtable, the Chamber of Commerce, I think they were very aware that there was a vacuum there. And although the state had bailed them out, as a result of bailing them out, the state incurred huge debts. And I think that there was a feeling on the part of the dominant corporations that if they did nothing, people would be demanding that the state actually stepped in and tried to regulate the economy, control the economy, nationalize banks, put single payer, do something to solve the economic crisis. And so having gotten bailed out, what they did is then turned on the government and said, the government is now unbalanced, and the answer is cutting the government, bringing it down to size. And I think a large part of this was, one, keeping that there won't be a vacuum for people to discuss other alternatives.